University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Barack Obama, a Chicago attorney, community organizer, and civil rights advocate, in his lecture, Community Revitalization. Obama is an attorney with the Chicago law firm of Davis, Minor, Barnhill, and Galland, where he specializes in civil rights litigation, real estate financing, acquisition, construction, and redevelopment of low- and moderate-income housing, and representation of not-for-profit organizations created to promote the welfare of low- and moderate-income urban communities. He is also an adjunct professor at the University of Chicago Law School, where he lectures on civil rights and social change. After graduating from Columbia University, Obama gained national attention in 1990 as a law student at Harvard University, where he was the first African-American to serve as editor of the prestigious Harvard Law Review. He graduated magna cum laude from Harvard in 1991. From 1985 to 1988, Obama served as executive director of the Developing Communities Project, a grassroots, church-based community development organization in Chicago's far south side. During his 4 years as director, Obama trained leadership from churches, public housing complexes, parent organizations, and block clubs to work collectively to restore housing, streets, and parks in the area, established counseling and tutorial programs for at-risk youth, created job training programs for the unemployed of the area, and forged partnerships between community leadership and the public schools to raise reading and math performance. In 1992, he served as director of Illinois Project Vote in Chicago, organizing and directing a voter registration and education campaign targeting minority and low-income voters in the Chicago area. Obama is also the author of Mixing Blood, Stories of Inheritance, to be published by Random House in 1995. Join us now for University Forum and Barack Obama.
Thank you very much. I've been wired for sound, so I suspect this should work. I'm very happy to be here today. I've never been to Lincoln. I was told when I was coming to Lincoln that I should know something about the Cornhuskers. Fortunately, on the flight, somebody announced the score of last night's game, so I'm up to speed. I myself did not play football. As you can probably tell by looking at me. Actually, I played 1 year of football when I was in ninth grade. We had a pretty mean coach. He wore dark glasses and chewed tobacco, and he'd spit at our shoes while we were playing. And that was my one experience with football. I was defensive end. I was a little bigger when I was young, and the coach. Told me I got clipped one day and sort of by the end, and the coach called me over and he said, "Next time I want you to step all over his back." And this was my best friend, and I decided that my football career was over. But I admire, I've seen some Cornhuskers, and I'm pretty impressed with their heft. I am here to talk about community involvement and community service. And it's a difficult thing, I think, to talk to young people about today because the setting has changed between when I was coming up, when I was sitting where you're sitting today, and where you are now. I did not grow up in the 60s, I wasn't in college in the 60s, that was my mother's generation. I'm sort of in between the baby boomers and Generation X, so-called. So your parents are the people who grew up in the 60s and marched in Vietnam. I came sort of at the tail end of that. But nevertheless, I was influenced greatly by that generation. And I always felt that young people were the agents of change in this country. And I think for a lot of your parents, that was the feeling. Many of them were inspired by the civil rights movement, by the anti-war movement, by the movement to expand women's rights in this country. And recently I've been reading a lot of articles, both in the New York Times and Newsweek and on MTV, about Generation X. And I guess you guys are considered Generation X. It's not a very flattering term. It sounds like a insecticide or something. But from what I've been told in these articles, this current generation is cynical and apathetic and generally doesn't believe in the value or utility of community participation. I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but that's the reputation. And so I've reflected on why that is. It's disturbing to me, because my sense is that at no time in our history has there been a greater need for community involvement, a greater need for idealism among young people. And so the question is why it is that young people have not been as active or involved as they might be. And I'm not sure. I don't have all the answers for this. I think some of it has to do with a disenchantment across the nation with what happened in the 60s. As you recall, the heyday of the 60s, there was a lot of clarity about the changes that needed to be brought about in this country. The civil rights movement dramatized the fact that there were certain portions of our society that were locked out, that were disenfranchised in dramatic fashion. And it was clear that there was wrong there that needed to be righted. I think for women of that generation, the sense that they were inhibited from living out their aspirations and dreams, that the choices that were available to them were in the kitchen, or as secretaries or as teachers, as opposed to attorneys or Supreme Court justices, that was, over time at least, became clear that that was something that needed to be changed. The Vietnam War and the cost in terms of lives and in terms of the economy was at least a more dramatic and easily identifiable issue that young people, I think, felt they could do something about. Today, the problems we face are more complex. The path towards betterment of the society isn't as clear. I think my expertise is in civil rights. And certainly for the African American and minority community in this country, the solutions that are available aren't as promising as they were back in the 60s. Some of you may have heard recently in Chicago of a young man, 11-year-old named Robert Sandoval, who was the object of a manhunt, although he was only 4 feet, 8 inches tall, and was only 13 years old because he was accused of having shot and killed a 14-year-old young girl. She happened to be in the line of some gang fire. And Mr. Sandoval, at the age of 13 or 14, had a rap sheet a mile long, had already been arrested 28 times, had been the victim of child abuse, had grown up in a public housing project in Chicago, an area where I used to organize. His mother was on welfare. His grandmother had been on welfare. There were drugs involved. He ended up, when they finally found him, he was already executed by other fellow gang members, shot in the back of the head twice. This is all at the age of 13. When we read reports like that, I think we have a difficult sense of what can we do about that kind of situation. What can we do about the collapse of the inner city? What can we do about young men who don't have any fathers and don't have any guidance and can't read and are unemployable? And are the civil rights strategies available in the 60s going to do anything for those young people? So In some ways, your generation, I think, is going to be confronting issues that aren't as amenable to easy solution. It's going to require long-term vision and long-term commitment in a way that your parents' generation, or even the generation that came immediately after your parents, didn't have to face. And I think that's a troubling thing, because this entire country, I think, has responded to the difficulties and complexities of the issues that we face today, whether it's environmental degradation or economic restructuring or the challenges that are we face in improving the educational system in this country. I think our reaction has generally been to withdraw. I think our reaction has generally been to become more privatized, more mean-spirited, more cynical about the possibilities of collective action, less optimistic about politics. I think that was exhibited pretty clearly in the recent debates in Congress. Everybody feels that government should be doing something, but nobody feels that government can do anything. And so our response tends to be to not vote. Our response tends to be not to get involved. Our major forms of entertainment, like Bart Simpson or Rush Limbaugh, are constantly displaying a deep-rooted cynicism about what we can accomplish together. What I'd like to do today is to talk a little bit about how we might break out of that cynicism, how we could potentially return to a notion in the 60s that was perhaps naive, and maybe we've learned some good lessons from that time, that in fact community participation is a good thing, that young people should be idealistic, that we can accomplish jointly some changes that are going to make this society fairer, more equitable, more prosperous, not just for the few, but for the many. To do that, I think what we're going to have to focus on is a concept of community that has been lost, not just in inner-city communities where the fabric of community has been torn asunder by drugs and crime and unemployment, but even our concept of community in places like Lincoln. As I was driving over, I was talking to a few people about what it must have been like in Lincoln, Nebraska, 50 years ago. And I suspect that there was a lot of hardship here. I suspect if you sit down and talk to your grandparents, they had to rely on each other. I think there was a sense that they couldn't make it on their own, that whether you come from a farming community or you were your grandparents worked in an industrial plant and were members of a union, the sense that community was important, that was the thing that held things together. Now, that's something that even in a place like Lincoln, I suspect, has been lost. You know, I don't know how many of you spend Saturday evenings talking to your grandparents or parents as opposed to watching television or staring at the VCR machine. But I suspect that even here we've lost a sense of community. Certainly nationally we've lost a sense of community. And to restore that community, I think as a starting point, we're going to have to talk about values. This is something that probably was a major mistake that was made in the 60s when we talked about social change. People didn't talk about values. People talked about power and they talked about injustice, but a lot of times values were ignored. Values have made a comeback. Dan Quayle talks about values, right? He talks about Murphy Brown and her lack of values. Bill Clinton talks about values. Jesse Jackson talks about values. So we have values bandied about all over the place. Politicians really like values now. Part of the reason for that is that values are cheap, at least the way they talk about them. You don't have to pay any money or tax anybody to talk about values. Family values, American values, values. I'm disturbed about how we talk about values. I think values are critical. I think that's how you build communities. But I also think that the term values is an empty vessel. It doesn't mean anything on its own. Values have to be acted upon. They have to be tested. Values are dynamic. And I think one of the things that you are going to have to think about in your lives, in your careers, and in your communities, is how do we test out our values? First, as I said, I think values are dynamic. Part of the reason that I don't trust Dan Quayle talking about values, and I often don't trust Bill Clinton talking about values, is they tend to have a static notion of values. Dan Quayle talks about values in terms of Ozzie and Harriet values. I think the values that they see on TV, and my wife, who's an attorney, she likes to watch old TV reruns, and so she watches Dick Van Dyke Show and Ozzie and Harriet and things like that. And I'm always struck by the values that are embodied in these television shows, which I think are the values that people have in mind when they talk about return to American values. The wife is at home. She's not working. You know, dad's got his 9-to-5. There are no African Americans in these family values. There's no discussion of poverty in these values. There's not much talk about the nuclear arm race that was taking place on these television programs. So the notion is that we can somehow return to that time and recapture those values without acknowledging all the things that were left out. Well, that's not the case. We have to figure out how to live out the American ideal or the values we have in terms of fairness and justice and family in an environment that's changed. And the only way we can do that is to act upon our values and test them out and see whether we can create new paradigms to live out those old values, those common values that we share. Acting on your values, I think, is critical. I suspect that in most of your classes, you're learning about values. You're reading Shakespeare, or you're reading Jefferson. But if we don't act out on our values, they don't mean much. I know that from personal experience, because when I was your age, I was an angry young man who thought that I had all kinds of values. I was a leader of student protest, and I wore dashikis, and I had a big afro. And when I look at pictures of the time, I'm always a little embarrassed. And I would read philosophers like Sartre and Fanon, and I was active in the South African apartheid struggle for disinvestment, and I would stay up late at night and have long conversations with my friends about values and politics, and we'd thrash the place. We'd thrash the dorms while we were having these conversations about values. We would leave beer bottles all over the place and put out our cigarettes in the carpet and all the time talking about values. And I remember waking up one morning and seeing the cleaning ladies come in having to clean up after our mess. And they were Mexican women, and they were stunned by the mess that we had left behind us. And I had to reflect at that point on the fact that despite the values I professed to believe in, I was not acting on my values. And I think that's typical not just of young people, typical not just of how I was. I think to some degree that's part of the mistake that we made in the 60s. That's why people are cynical about idealism. I think that the values that we professed about a belief in racial justice, or the values that we said we believed in terms of the environment, or all kinds of values that we talked about, we didn't always act out in our personal lives. We didn't always make the choices required to take responsibility for those values. It's easy to believe in civil rights and integration and busing if you send your kids to a private school, right? It's easy to believe in gender equality if you're wealthy enough to hire a maid so that you can have your career and somebody's cleaning up after you. It's easy to believe in environmental regulation when your dad does not work in a steel plant and is not going to be potentially laid off because of increased environmental regulation. It's harder to believe in these values when you actually test them out, because it turns out that values are often in tension, that it's not easy to live up to your ideals and your values. It requires sacrifice. It may require taxes on the part of the society. It may require that you go without certain luxuries that you've become accustomed to. If you don't live out those values, they don't mean much. And I think part of the cynicism we have about politics right now is a politics of symbolism that talks about values but does not live them out. And we all know that. That's why people don't listen to politicians and we don't get involved, because we know that we say one thing and we do another thing, both personally and and in the society. And so I would challenge you first to think about what your values are and think about whether you're living them out. Think about whether the things you read in these books, in your classes, about equality or justice, whether you live those out, whether you're contributing to the promotion of these values, or whether you're just giving lip service to them and not living them out. That's the first thing I have to say about values. And I think that was a mistake that we've made in the past, is to think that living up to our ideals and values is easy, that we can do it on the cheap, that we can take shortcuts. That's not the case. The second thing I think that we made a mistake about in the 60s, I know I've made mistakes in terms of my community involvement in the past, is the notion that being involved in community service or being involved in politics is a matter of being against something as opposed to being for something. I think this was a major mistake that many of us made. There's a notion that the system, quote-unquote, needs to be changed, and that all we need to do is just complain about it. Throw the bums out. Get on the picket line. The corporate interests, all kinds of slogan and jargons that were thrown around in the 60s and aren't thrown around as much now, because I think people recognize that, we've seen the enemy and it is us. There is no they out there, whether you think that they is white people, or you think that they is black people, or you think that they are corporate interests, or you think that they is unions. Well, they're all us. Community involvement requires that you be for something, not just against something, that you don't just complain about how messed up things are, but that you figure out how to bring about some solutions to these problems. I know that at Harvard, one of the most frustrating things about student life at Harvard was, I guess, what's called political correctness in the media. Now, political correctness, I tend not to be that sympathetic to people who cry about political correctness and complain about, the liberals and the minorities who are giving conservatives a hard time. I think that there's nothing wrong with giving somebody a hard time if they're being insensitive to other people's feelings, if they're being rude, if they're telling racist jokes, if they're telling sexist jokes. I don't think that there's anything wrong with telling them where they're wrong. But I do think that what's happened in a place like Harvard, and maybe happens less so here, is that young people tend to jump with both feet on a whole lot of symbolic issues. I remember when I was organizing at Harvard, When I was the manager of the Law Review at Harvard, I had a young black woman come into me and complain vehemently about the fact that the word black was not capitalized in an article, whereas she felt that black that should be capitalized because that would show more respect for the black community. Well, you know, then a white editor came in. He started complaining, why should black be capitalized when white's not capitalized? Now, this seems like a ridiculous argument, but this is the kind of thing that a lot of students, groups, a lot of well-meaning idealists spend their time on. I think there are a lot of academics that spend their time on it. I'm not sure that's really useful. I think it's a matter of symbols and not substance. And I think it indicates our willingness to try to, instead of making the sacrifices that are required to really bring about changes, I think it's an indication of our sense of powerlessness, that we just complain about things, that we pick at, you know, small issues, instead of taking on and really engaging the major issues that face our country right now. So I think that as you think about community service, you've got to be concerned about being for something and not just against something. That's particularly important in inner city communities where to rebuild these communities, we're going to have to figure out how to create jobs in these areas. We're going to have to figure out how to fix up schools. We're going to have to create new paradigms to revitalize these communities. And that's not just going to involve protest and complaint. That's something that's changed from the 60s. We're not going to be able to just march. We're going to have to really roll up our sleeves and figure out how to do it. And that's going to be more challenging. And that's something that I expect all of you could make a great contribution towards. But it's going to require some sacrifice. And it's going to require some effort. So be for something, not just against something. The third thing that I want to talk about is this whole notion of service. I tend not to use the term service in thinking about community. I usually use the word self-interest. I don't get involved with the community. I don't do the things that I do. I don't get involved with civil rights. I don't organize. I don't work in low-income communities because I feel that I'm more fortunate and I have to give back to this community. Although I am fortunate and I do have to give back to this community, I don't do it out of a sense of charity. I don't do it out of a sense of guilt. I think the reason that you get involved with community is a recognition that your individual fate, your individual salvation, is tied to the larger group. You do it because you recognize that in your gut, the story of your life is connected to the story of other people's lives. In Chicago, right now, the black community and the Hispanic community is suffering a great deal of crime. And I think for a long time, the white community in the city has felt that's a minority problem. But of course, what's happening now is that it's starting to spill over into the white community. The fact that these are the school systems don't work in the inner city affects the economic viability of the city. It means that corporations are moving out into the suburbs. The fact that housing is not working very well and public housing is not working very well and that it's collapsing. Well, what that means is that the tax burden on the entire city is increased. And so the reason that you should get involved in community service, even in Lincoln, as pretty as it is and as isolated in some ways from these major urban problems as it seems, the reason you should get involved in community service is because over the long term, what happens in these communities, what happens to people in the inner city, what happens to that 11-year-old who's being shot, is going to have a direct impact on you. It's going to have an impact in terms of the viability of the economy of this country. It's going to have an impact in terms of your life chances and your the opportunities for your career. It's going to have an impact in terms of the lives of your children, because they're going to be threatened by crime and violence in a way that your parents were not and you were not. The reason you do it is because of your self-interest. That's the most important reason for getting involved. Because if you get involved with guilt, on the basis of guilt, guilt usually doesn't last. Right? Good feelings and charity don't last that long. That's what happened in the 60s. A lot of people got involved because they were feeling charitable. But when you started to have to make tough choices about where you lived and where you sent your kids to school and what kinds of careers you had, charity went by the wayside. The reason to get involved is because your self-interest is tied to these people. And the other reason is because of a recognition that in your own history, in your own story, people have had to struggle along the way. I know that one of the things for me that motivates me to do what I do is the fact that I know that my grandparents lived through a depression and that the struggles they went through are part of me. They're part of my story. That when I see poor people on the street, those are my relatives at some point in time. That when I see minorities who've been locked out, those are me, even if I'm not directly discriminated against. And that's true across race and across gender barriers. I think a lot of college students are big on diversity, and we talk about diversity and multiculturalism. Well, I think that's good. I think diversity is the agent for excellence. People talk about diversity and excellence being in conflict. I don't think that's the case. I think diversity is an agent for excellence. It helps us drop away our blinders. We all come into college and we all have blind spots. But I also am concerned when people talk about diversity only in terms of people who are most like us, so that black students believe in diversity when it applies to us or when it applies to white persons who think like us, but we're not so keen about diversity when it comes to Joe Sixpack. You know, we don't have to think in terms of diversity because those people are rednecks or they're racist. White folks, we believe, many white students believe in diversity as long as, you know, they the black people or the Hispanics or the Asians that they meet talk like them, and are educated like them, and you read Toni Morrison or James Baldwin and you feel really liberal, but when it comes to a poor young black, then you don't feel like diversity is such a good thing, right? And I think that's a concern that I've got. You've got to recognize that your story in some way is connected not just to the people who are most like you, but also the people who are most different from you. That in this country, all of you have at some point come from immigrant backgrounds. Very few of us were, our parents came over on the Mayflower. If you're Irish, somehow, somewhere along the line, you came over because you were fleeing famine. If you're Italian, you came over in some sense because there was greater opportunity in your, somebody in your family landed on Ellis Island. If you're Hispanic, same as the case. Obviously, if you're African American, you didn't come here voluntarily. All of us, somewhere along the line, are connected to struggle. That's part of our story. And the reason to get involved in community is because you're living out your own story. That's the reason you do it. That's the lasting reason. Because you recognize that the only way that you're going to get a sense of self and a sense of meaning is if you connect up with a larger story. And I can't emphasize that enough. I know that when I first got involved in organizing in Harlem, I was out there because of liberal guilt. And I got disabused of that real quickly. I was working for a group called NYPIRG, a public interest research group. And they were big on recycling. This was connected to Ralph Nader. And they sent me out into the middle of Harlem to try to get people involved in environmental and recycling issues. And as you might imagine, the folks in Harlem weren't all that interested in getting involved. And I would guilt them all the time. You know, I would say, well, now don't be apathetic. These are important issues and this and that and the other. No. They weren't interested because I wasn't speaking to their self-interest, right? I wasn't cooking up with the story that they were living out every day, which is a story of want and a story of facing indifference and lack of opportunity. I had to address their self-interest, not their guilt. And I had to address my own self-interest and not my guilt. When I went to Harvard after... And I'm going to wrap up and open up to questions after this. But I'll close with a story and a bit of advice that a pastor friend of mine gave to me when I was leaving for Harvard after having organized in low-income communities for 4 or 5 years. And I was a little troubled about the notion of going off to Harvard. I thought that maybe I was betraying my ideals and not living up to my values. I was feeling guilty, and this pastor friend of mine who was an older gentleman, he had been in the civil rights struggle for a long time, I went to talk to him, and he said, go to Harvard, it'll be good for you, you'll learn a lot. He said, but one thing, don't let Harvard change you. Don't let Harvard change you. And I didn't know exactly what he meant, don't let Harvard change you, because... He knew that I didn't come from the streets of Chicago. He didn't mean don't let Harvard educate you. He didn't mean that you're not going to meet new people and get new ideas. I think what he meant was don't forget the larger story that you're a part of. He also meant don't misplace your dreams. I think the danger that all of you are going to confront as you leave college and start entering into your careers is the process whereby young people's dreams get misplaced. Among attorneys who come into law school and are very idealistic and then go on into legal careers, there's a constant process where your dreams are chipped away. So that if you sit down with attorneys in Chicago who had gone in there thinking they were going to be Clarence Darrow or Thurgood Marshall, they're now talking about the BMW that they can buy. Or the fur coat. Now that disturbs me. And I think that's what disturbed my pastor when he talked about don't let Harvard change you. You know, I am disturbed that the fur coat or the BMW or whatever you like to spend your money on has become the big payoff in your life. So that you are willing to work in jobs that may not hold much meaning for you. And you are willing to work long hours in things that you don't believe in, that may draw you away from your community and your values and your passions, that you're willing to let somebody else determine what your goals are, that your dreams get sanitized and deodorized and packaged and advertised, and you buy them on a Visa Gold card, and that somewhere along the line, your best hopes and your best dreams and your best ideals about what you could accomplish in your life, what you could do for other people, what would inspire you and challenge you, have been set aside. Don't let that happen to you. It is going to require that you struggle and test out your values and act on your beliefs. But in the end, that's the only way that you are going to be able to live out the best impulses inside of you. That's the only way that you're going to be able to be true to your ideals and the ideals of the people who came before you. And so I hope, I'll leave some time open for questions, I hope that all of you, as you're considering both your involvement in community here at the university and, more importantly, your community involvement as you think about careers and where you're going to go after this, that you all hang on to your dreams and you don't simply think in terms of what you can buy and how you can protect yourselves from the problems around you, that you instead engage and challenge yourself to do something about those problems. Thank you.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Chicago attorney, community organizer, and civil rights advocate Barack Obama. His lecture was entitled Community Revitalization. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.